Chapter 4. The Witness of the Heretics. Christ founded the church with two great figures of speech in the final words to the apostles who received authority to found it. The first was the phrase about founding it on Peter as on a rock. The second was the symbol of the keys. About the meaning of the former, there is, naturally, no doubt in my own case, but it does not directly affect the argument here, save in two more secondary aspects. It is yet another example of a thing that could only fully expand and explain itself afterwards, and even long afterwards. And it is yet another example of something the very reverse of simple and self-evident even in the language, insofar as it described a man as a rock when he had much more the appearance of a reed. But the other image of the keys has an exactitude that has hardly been exactly noticed. The keys have been conspicuous enough in the art and heraldry of Christendom, but not everyone has noted the peculiar aptness of the allegory. We have now reached the point in history where something must be said of the first appearance and activities of the church in the Roman Empire. And for that brief description, nothing could be more perfect than that ancient metaphor. The early Christian was very precisely a person carrying about a key, or what he said was a key. The whole Christian movement consisted in claiming to possess that key. It was not merely a vague forward movement, which might be better represented by a battering ram. It was not something that swept along with its similar or dissimilar things, as does a modern social movement. As we shall see in a moment, it rather definitely refused to do so. It definitely asserted that there was a key, and that it possessed that key, and that no other key was like it. In that sense, it was as narrow as you please, only it happened to be the key that could unlock the prison of the whole world and let in the white daylight of liberty. The creed was like a key in three respects, which can be most conveniently summed up under this symbol. First, a key is above all things a thing with a shape. It is a thing that depends entirely upon keeping its shape. The Christian creed is above all things the philosophy of shapes and the enemy of shapelessness. That is where it differs from all that formless infinity Manichaean or Buddhist which makes a sort of pool of night in the dark heart of Asia, the ideal of uncreating all the creatures. That is where it differs also from the analogous vagueness of mere evolutionism, the idea of creatures constantly losing their shape. A man told that his solitary latch key had been melted down with a million others into a Buddhistic unity would be annoyed. But a man told that his key was gradually growing and sprouting in his pocket and branching into new wards or complications would not be more gratified. Second, the shape of a key is in itself a rather fantastic shape. A savage who did not know it was a key would have the greatest difficulty in guessing what it could possibly be. And it is fantastic because it is, in a sense, arbitrary. A key is not a matter of abstractions. In that sense, a key is not a matter of argument. It either fits the lock or it does not. It is useless for men to stand disputing over it considered by itself or reconstructing it on pure principles of geometry or decorative art. It is senseless for a man to say he would like a simpler key. It would be far more sensible to do his best with a crowbar. And thirdly, as the key is necessarily a thing with a pattern, so this was one having in some ways a rather elaborate pattern. When people complain of the religion being so early complicated with theology and things of the kind, they forget that the world had not only got into a hole, but had got into a whole maze of holes and corners. The problem itself was a complicated problem. It did not, in the ordinary sense, merely involve anything so simple as sin. It was also full of secrets, of unexplored and unfathomable fallacies, of unconscious mental diseases, of dangers in all directions. If the faith had faced the world only with the platitudes about peace and simplicity some moralists would confine it to, it would not have had the faintest effect on that luxurious and labyrinthine lunatic asylum. What it did do, we must now roughly describe. It is enough to say here that there was undoubtedly much more about the key that seemed complex. Indeed, there was only one thing about it that was simple. It opened the door. There are certain recognized and accepted statements in this matter, which may for brevity and convenience be described as lies. We have all heard people say that Christianity arose in an age of barbarism. They might just as well say that Christian Science arose in an age of barbarism. They may think Christianity was a symptom of social decay, as I think Christian Science a symptom of mental decay. They may think Christianity is superstition that ultimately destroyed a civilization, as I think Christian Science a superstition capable, if taken seriously, of destroying any number of civilizations. But to say that a Christian of the 4th or 5th centuries was a barbarian living in a barbarous time is exactly like saying that Mrs. Eddy was a Red Indian. And if I allowed my constitutional impatience with Mrs. Eddy to impel me to call her a Red Indian, I should incidentally be telling a lie. We may like or dislike the imperial civilization of Rome in the 4th century. We may like or dislike the industrial civilization of America in the 19th century. But that they both were what we commonly mean by a civilization, no person of common sense could deny if he wanted to. This is a very obvious fact, but it is also a very fundamental one, and we must make it the foundation of any further description of constructive Christianity in the past. For good or evil, it was preeminently the product of a civilized age, perhaps of an over-civilized age. This is the first fact, apart from all praise or blame. Indeed, I am so unfortunate as not to feel that I praise a thing when I compare it to Christian Science. But it is at least desirable to know something of the savor of a society in which we are condemning or praising anything. And the science that connects Mrs. Eddy with tomahawks or the Mater Dolorosa with totems may, for our general convenience, be eliminated. The dominant fact, not merely about the Christian religion, but about the whole pagan civilization, was that which has been more than once repeated in these pages. The Mediterranean was a lake in the real sense of a pool, in which a number of different cults or cultures were, as the phrase goes, pooled. Those cities facing each other round the circle of the lake became more and more one cosmopolitan culture. On its legal and military side, it was the Roman Empire, but it was very many-sided. It might be called superstitious in the sense that it contained a great number of varied superstitions, but by no possibility can any part of it be called barbarous. In this level of cosmopolitan culture arose the Christian religion and the Catholic Church. And everything in the story suggests that it was felt to be something new and strange. Those who have tried to suggest that it evolved out of something much milder or more ordinary have found that in this case, their evolutionary method is very difficult to apply. They may suggest that Essenes or Ebionites or such things were the seed, but the seed is invisible. The tree appears very rapidly full grown, and the tree is something totally different. It is certainly a Christmas tree, in the sense that it keeps the kindliness and moral beauty of the story of Bethlehem. But it was as ritualistic as the seven-branched candlestick, and the candles it carried were considerably more than were probably permitted by the first prayer book of Edward VI. It might well be asked, indeed, why anyone accepting the Bethlehem tradition should object to golden or gilded ornaments, since the Magi themselves brought gold. why he should dislike incense in the church, since incense was brought even to the stable. But these are controversies that do not concern me here. I am concerned only with the historical fact, more and more admitted by historians, that very early in its history, this thing became visible to the civilization of antiquity, and that already the church appeared as a church, with everything that is implied in a church and much that is disliked in a church. We will discuss in a moment how far it was like other ritualistic or magical or ascetical mysteries in its own time. It was certainly not in the least like merely ethical and idealistic movements in our time. It had a doctrine, it had a discipline, it had sacraments, it had degrees of initiation. It admitted people and expelled people. It affirmed one dogma with authority and reputed another with anathemas. If all these things be the marks of Antichrist, the reign of Antichrist followed very rapidly upon Christ. Those who maintain that Christianity was not a church but a moral movement of idealists have been forced to push the period of its perversion or disappearance further and further back. A bishop of Rome writes, claiming authority in the very lifetime of St. John the Evangelist, and it is described as the first papal aggression. A friend of the apostles writes of them as men he knew, and says they taught him the doctrine of the sacrament. And Mr. Wells can only murmur that the reaction towards barbaric blood rites may have happened rather earlier than might be expected. The date of the fourth gospel, which at one time was steadily growing later and later, is now steadily growing earlier and earlier, until critics are staggered at the dawning and dreadful possibility that it might be something like what it professes to be. The last limit of an early date for the extinction of true Christianity has probably been found by the latest German professor whose authority is invoked by Dean Inge. This learned scholar says that Pentecost was the occasion for the first founding of an ecclesiastical, dogmatic, and despotic church utterly alien to the simple ideals of Jesus of Nazareth. This may be called, in a popular as well as a learned sense, the limit. What do professors of this kind imagine that men are made of? Suppose it were a matter of any merely human movement, let us say that of the conscientious objectors. Some say the early Christians were pacifists. I do not believe it for a moment, but I am quite ready to accept the parallel for the sake of the argument. Tolstoy, or some great preacher of peace among peasants, has been shot as a mutineer for defying conscription. And a little while afterwards, his fellow followers meet together in an upper room in remembrance of him. They never had any reason for coming together except that common memory. They are men of many kinds with nothing to bind them, except that the greatest event in all their lives was this tragedy of the teacher of universal peace. They are always repeating his words, revolving his problems, trying to imitate his character. The pacifists meet at their Pentecost and are possessed of a sudden ecstasy of enthusiasm and wild rush of the whirlwind of inspiration, in the course of which they proceed to establish universal conscription, to increase the Navy estimates, to insist on everybody going about armed to the teeth and on all the frontiers bristling with artillery. The proceedings concluded with a singing of "Boys of the Bulldog Breed and Don't Let Them Scrap the British Navy." That is something like a fair parallel to the theory of these critics, that the transition from their idea of Jesus to their idea of Catholicism could have been made in the little upper room at Pentecost. Surely anybody's common sense would tell them that enthusiasts who only met through their common enthusiasm for a leader whom they loved would not instantly rush away to establish everything that he hated. No, if the ecclesiastical and dogmatic system is as old as Pentecost, it is as old as Christmas. If we trace it back to such very early Christians, we must trace it back to Christ. We may begin, then, with these two negations. It is nonsense to say that the Christian faith appeared in a simple age, in the sense of an unlettered and gullible age. It is equally nonsense to say that the Christian faith was a simple thing, in the sense of a vague or childish or merely instinctive thing. Perhaps the only point in which we could possibly say that the church fitted into the pagan world is the fact that they were both not only highly civilized, but rather complicated. They were both emphatically many-sided, but antiquity was then a many-sided whole, like a hexagonal hole, waiting for an equally hexagonal stopper. In that sense, only the church was many-sided enough to fit the world. The six sides of the Mediterranean world faced each other across the sea and waited for something that should look all ways at once. The church had to be both Roman and Greek and Jewish and African and Asiatic. In the very words of the Apostle of the Gentiles, it was indeed all things to all men. Christianity then was not merely crude and simple, it was the very reverse of the growth of a barbaric time. But when we come to the contrary charge, we come to a much more plausible charge. It is very much more tenable that the faith was but the final phase of the decay of civilization, in the sense of the excess of civilization. That this superstition was a sign that Rome was dying and dying of being much too civilized. That is an argument much better worth considering, and we will proceed to consider it. At the beginning of this book, I ventured on a general summary of it in a parallel between the rise of humanity out of nature and the rise of Christianity out of history. I pointed out that in both cases, what had gone before might imply something coming after, but did not in the least imply what did come after. If a detached mind had seen certain apes, it might have deduced more anthropoids. It would not have deduced man or anything within 1,000 miles of what man has done. In short, it might have seen Pithecanthropus or the missing link looming in the future, if possible, almost as dimly and doubtfully as we see him looming in the past. But if it foresaw him appearing, it would also foresee him disappearing, leaving a few faint traces, just as he has left a few faint traces, if they are traces. To foresee that missing link would not be to foresee man or anything like man. Now, this earlier explanation must be kept in mind because it is an exact parallel to the true view of the church, and the suggestion of it having evolved naturally out of the empire in decay. The truth is that in one sense, a man might very well have predicted that the imperial decadence would produce something like Christianity. That is, something a little like and gigantically different. A man might very well have said, for instance, pleasure has been pursued so extravagantly that there will be a reaction into pessimism. Perhaps it will take the form of asceticism. Men will mutilate themselves instead of merely hanging themselves. Or a man might very reasonably have said, if we weary of our Greek and Latin gods, we shall be hankering after some Eastern mystery or other. There will be a fashion in Persians or Hindus. Or a man of the world might well have been shrewd enough to say, powerful people are picking up these fads. Someday the court will adopt one of them, and it may become official. Or yet another and gloomier prophet might be pardoned for saying, the world is going downhill. Dark and barbarous superstitions will return. It does not matter much which. They will all be formless and fugitive like dreams of the night. Now, it is the intense interest of the case that all these prophecies were really fulfilled. But it was not the church that fulfilled them. It was the church that escaped from them, confounded them, and rose above them in triumph. Insofar as it was probable that the mere nature of hedonism would produce a mere reaction of asceticism, It did produce a mere reaction of asceticism. It was the movement called Manichaean, and the church was its mortal enemy. Insofar as it would have naturally appeared at that point of history, it did appear. It did also disappear, which was equally natural. The mere pessimist reaction did come with the Manichaeans and did go with the Manichaeans. But the church did not come with them or go with them, and she had much more to do with their going than with their coming. Or again, insofar as it was probable that even the growth of skepticism would bring in a fashion of Eastern religion, it did bring it in. Mithras came from far beyond Palestine, out of the heart of Persia, bringing strange mysteries of the blood of bulls. Certainly there was everything to show that some such fashion would have come in any case, but certainly there is nothing in the world to show that it would not have passed away in any case. Certainly an Oriental fad was something eminently fitted to the 4th or 5th century, but that hardly explains it having remained to the 20th century and still going strong. In short, insofar as things of the kind might have been expected then, things like Mithraism were experienced then. But it scarcely explains our more recent experiences. And if we were still Mithraists merely because Mithraic headdresses and other perturbatuses might be expected to be all the rage in the days of Domitian, it would almost seem by this time that we must be a little dowdy. It is the same, as will be suggested in a moment, with the idea of official favoritism. Insofar as such favoritism shown towards a fad was something that might have been looked for during the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, it was something that did exist in that empire and did decline and fall with it. It throws no sort of light on the thing that resolutely refused to decline and fall, that grew steadily while the other was declining and falling, and which, even at this moment, is going forward with fearless energy when another eon has completed its cycle and another civilization seems almost ready to fall or to decline. Now, the curious fact is this, that the very heresies which the early churches blamed for crushing testify to the unfairness for which she is blamed. Insofar as something deserved the blame, it was precisely the things that she is blamed for blaming. Insofar as something was merely a superstition, she herself condemned that superstition. Insofar as something was a mere reaction into barbarism, she herself resisted it because it was a reaction into barbarism. Insofar as something was a fad of the fading empire that died and deserved to die, it was the church alone that killed it. The church is reproached for being exactly what the heresy was repressed for being. The explanations of the evolutionary historians and higher critics do really explain why Arianism and Gnosticism and Nestorianism were born, and also why they died. They do not explain why the church was born or why she has refused to die. Above all, they do not explain why she should have made war on the very evils she is supposed to share. Let us take a few practical examples of the principle. The principle that if there was anything that was really a superstition of the dying empire, it did really die with the dying empire, and certainly was not the same as the very thing that destroyed it. For this purpose, we will take in order two or three of the most ordinary explanations of Christian origins among the modern critics of Christianity. Nothing is more common, for instance, than to find such a modern critic writing something like this: Christianity was above all a movement of ascetics, a rush into the desert, a refuge in the cloister, a renunciation of all life and happiness, and this was a part of a gloomy and inhuman reaction against nature itself, a hatred of the body, a horror of the material universe, a sort of universal suicide of the senses and even of the self. It came from an Eastern fanaticism, like that of the fakirs, and was ultimately founded on an Eastern pessimism, which seems to feel existence itself as an evil. Now, the most extraordinary thing about this is that it is all quite true. It is true in every detail except that it happens to be attributed entirely to the wrong person. It is not true of the church, but it is true of the heretics condemned by the church. It is as if one were to write a most detailed analysis of the mistakes and misgovernment of the ministers of George III, merely with the small inaccuracy that the whole story was told about George Washington. Or as if somebody made a list of the crimes of the Bolshevists, with no variation except that they were all attributed to the Tsar. The early church was indeed very ascetic in connection with a totally different philosophy, but the philosophy of a war on life and nature as such really did exist in the world if the critics only knew where to look for it. What really happened was this. When the faith first emerged into the world, the very first thing that happened to it was that it was caught in a sort of swarm of mystical and metaphysical sects, mostly out of the East, like one lonely golden bee caught in a swarm of wasps. To the ordinary onlooker, there did not seem to be much difference or anything beyond a general buzz. Indeed, in a sense, there was not much difference so far as stinging and being stung were concerned. The difference was that only one golden dot in all that whirring gold dust had the power of going forth to make hives for all humanity, to give the world honey and wax, or, as was so finely said in a context too easily forgotten, the two noblest things which are sweetness and light. The wasps all died that winter, and half the difficulty is that hardly anyone knows anything about them, and most people do not know that they ever existed. So that the whole story of that first phase of our religion is lost. Or to vary the metaphor, when this movement or some other movement pierced the dike between the East and West and brought more mystical ideas into Europe, it brought with it a whole flood of other mystical ideas besides its own, most of them ascetical, and nearly all of them pessimistic. They very nearly flooded and overwhelmed the purely Christian element. They came mostly from that region that was a sort of dim borderland between the Eastern philosophies and the Eastern mythologies, and which shared with the wilder philosophers that curious craze for making fantastic patterns of the cosmos in the shape of maps and genealogical trees. Those that are supposed to derive from the mysterious Manes are called Manichaean. Kindred cults are more generally known as Gnostic. They are mostly of a labyrinthine complexity, but the point to insist on is the pessimism. The fact that nearly all in one form or another regarded the creation of the world as the work of an evil spirit. Some of them had that Asiatic atmosphere that surrounds Buddhism. The suggestion that life is a corruption of the purity of being. Some of them suggested a purely spiritual order which had been betrayed by the coarse and clumsy trick of making such toys as the sun and moon and stars. Anyhow, all this dark tide out of the metaphysical sea in the midst of Asia poured through the dikes simultaneously with the creed of Christ. But it is the whole point of the story that the two were not the same, that they flowed like oil and water. That creed remained in the shape of a miracle, a river still flowing through the sea. And the proof of the miracle was practical once more. It was merely that while all that sea was salt and bitter with the savor of death, of this one stream in the midst of it, a man could drink. Now that purity was preserved by dogmatic definitions and exclusions. It could not possibly have been preserved by anything else. If the church had not renounced the Manichaeans, it might have become merely Manichaean. If it had not renounced the Gnostics, it might have become Gnostic. But by the very fact that it did renounce them, it proved that it was not either Gnostic or Manichaean. At any rate, it proved that something was not either Gnostic or Manichaean. What could it be that condemned them if it was not the original good news of the runners from Bethlehem and the trumpet of the resurrection? The early church was ascetic, but she proved that she was not pessimistic simply by condemning the pessimists. The creed declared that man was sinful, but it did not declare that life was evil, and it proved it by damning those who did. The condemnation of the early heretics is itself condemned as something crabbed and narrow, but it was in truth the very proof that the church meant to be brotherly and broad. It proved that the primitive Catholics were especially eager to explain that they did not think man utterly vile, that they did not think life incurably miserable, that they did not think marriage a sin or procreation a tragedy. They were ascetic because asceticism was the only possible purge of the sins of the world. But in the very thunder of their anathemas, they affirmed forever that their asceticism was not to be anti-human or anti-natural, that they did wish to purge the world and not destroy it. And nothing else except those anathemas could possibly have made it clear amid a confusion which still confuses them with their mortal enemies. Nothing else but dogma could have resisted the riot of imaginative invention with which the pessimists were waging their war against nature, with their eons and their demiurge, their strange logos and their sinister Sophia. If the church had not insisted on theology, it would have melted into a mad mythology of the mystics yet further removed from reason or even from rationalism, and above all, yet further removed from life and from the love of life. Remember that it would have been an inverted mythology, one contradicting everything natural in paganism, a mythology in which Pluto would be above Jupiter and Hades hang higher than Olympus, in which Brahma and all that has the breath of life would be subject to Shiva, shining with the eye of death. That the early church was itself full of an ecstatic enthusiasm for renunciation and virginity makes this distinction much more striking and not less so. It makes all the more important the place where the dogma drew the line. A man might crawl about on all fours like a beast because he was an ascetic. He might stand night and day on the top of a pillar and be adored for being an ascetic. But he could not say that the world was a mistake or the marriage state a sin without being a heretic. What was it that thus deliberately disengaged itself from Eastern asceticism by sharp definition and fierce refusal, if it was not something with an individuality of its own, and one that was quite different? If the Catholics are to be confused with the Gnostics, we can only say it was not their fault if they are, and it is rather hard that the Catholics should be blamed by the same critics for persecuting the heretics and also for sympathizing with the heresy. The church was not a Manichaean movement, if only because it was not a movement at all. It was not even merely an ascetical movement, because it was not a movement at all. It would be nearer the truth to call it the tamer of asceticism than the mere leader or loosener of it. It was a thing having its own theory of asceticism, its own type of asceticism, but most conspicuous at the moment as the moderator of other theories and types. This is the only sense that can be made, for instance, of the story of St. Augustine. As long as he was a mere man of the world, a mere man drifting with his time, he was actually a Manichaean. It really was quite modern and fashionable to be a Manichaean. But when he became a Catholic, the people he instantly turned on and rent in pieces were the Manichaeans. The Catholic way of putting it is that he left off being a pessimist to become an ascetic. But as the pessimists interpreted asceticism, it might be said that he left off being an ascetic to become a saint. the war upon life, the denial of nature, were exactly the things he had already found in the heathen world outside the church and had to renounce when he entered the church. The very fact that St. Augustine remains a somewhat sterner or sadder figure than St. Francis or St. Teresa only accentuates the dilemma. Face to face with the gravest or even grimmest of Catholics, we can still ask, why did Catholicism make war on Manichaeans if Catholicism was Manichaean? Take another rationalistic explanation of the rise of Christendom. It is common enough to find another critic saying, Christianity did not really rise at all, that is, it did not merely rise from below, it was imposed from above. It is an example of the power of the executive, especially in despotic states. The empire was really an empire, that is, it was ruled really by the emperor. One of the emperors happened to become a Christian. He might just as well have become a Mithraist or a Jew or a fire worshipper. It was common in the decline of the empire for eminent and educated people to adopt these eccentric Eastern cults. But when he adopted it, it became the official religion of the Roman Empire. And when it became the official religion of the Roman Empire, it became as strong, as universal, and as invincible as the Roman Empire. It has only remained in the world as a relic of that empire, or, as many have put it, it is but the ghost of Caesar still hovering over Rome. This also is a very ordinary line taken in the criticism of orthodoxy, to say that it was only officialism that ever made it orthodoxy. And here again, we can call on the heretics to refute it. The whole great history of the Arian heresy might have been invented to explode this idea. It is a very interesting history, often repeated in this connection, and the upshot of it is, in that insofar as there ever was a merely official religion, it actually died because it was merely an official religion, and what destroyed it was the real religion. Arius advanced a version of Christianity which moved, more or less vaguely, in the direction of what we should call Unitarianism, though it was not the same, for it gave to Christ a curious intermediary position between the divine and human. The point is that it seemed to many more reasonable and less fanatical, and among these were many of the educated class in a sort of reaction against the first romance of conversion. Arians were a sort of moderates and a sort of modernists, and it was felt that after the first squabbles, this was the final form of rationalized religion into which civilization might well settle down. It was accepted by Divus Caesar himself and became the official orthodoxy. The generals and military princes drawn from the new barbarian powers of the north, full of the future, supported it strongly. But the sequel is still more important. Exactly as a modern man might pass through Unitarianism to complete agnosticism, so the greatest of the Arian emperors ultimately shed the last and thinnest pretense of Christianity. He abandoned even Arius and returned to Apollo. He was a Caesar of the Caesars, a soldier, a scholar, a man of large ambitions and ideals, another of the philosopher kings. It seemed to him as if at his signal the sun rose again. The oracles began to speak like birds beginning to sing at dawn. Paganism was itself again. The gods returned. It seemed the end of that strange interlude of an alien superstition, and indeed it was the end of it so far as there was a mere interlude of mere superstition. It was the end of it insofar as it was the fad of an emperor or the fashion of a generation. If there really was something that began with Constantine, then it ended with Julian. But there was something that did not end. There had arisen in that hour of history, defiant above the democratic tumult of the councils of the church, Athanasius against the world. we may pause upon the point at issue, because it is relevant to the whole of this religious history, and the modern world seems to miss the whole point of it. We might put it this way. If there is one question which the enlightened and liberal have the habit of deriding and holding up as a dreadful example of barren dogma and senseless sectarian strife, it is this Athanasian question of the co-eternity of the divine Son. On the other hand, if there is one thing that the same liberals always offer us as a piece of pure and simple Christianity, untroubled by doctrinal disputes, it is the single sentence, God is love. Yet the two statements are almost identical. At least one is very nearly nonsense without the other. The barren dogma is only the logical way of stating the beautiful sentiment. For if there be a being without beginning, existing before all things, was he loving when there was nothing to be loved? If through that unthinkable eternity he is lonely, what is the meaning of saying he is love? The only justification of such a mystery is the mystical conception that in his own nature there was something analogous to self-expression, something of what begets and beholds what it has begotten. Without some such idea, it is really illogical to complicate the ultimate essence of deity with an idea like love. If the moderns really want a simple religion of love, they must look for it in the Athanasian Creed. The truth is that the trumpet of true Christianity, the challenge of the charities and simplicities of Bethlehem or Christmas Day, never rang out more arrestingly and unmistakably than in the defiance of Athanasius to the cold compromise of the Arians. It was emphatically he who really was fighting for a God of love against a God of colorless and remote cosmic control, the God of the Stoics and the Agnostics. It was emphatically he who was fighting for the Holy Child against the great deity of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. He was fighting for that very balance of beautiful interdependence and intimacy in the very trinity of the divine nature that draws our hearts to the trinity of the Holy Family. His dogma, if the phrase be not misunderstood, turns even God into a Holy Family. That this purely Christian dogma actually for a second time rebelled against the empire, and actually for a second time refounded the church in spite of the empire, is itself a proof that there was something positive and personal working in the world other than whatever official faith the empire chose to adopt. This power utterly destroyed the official faith that the empire did adopt. It went on its own way, as it is going on its own way still. There are any number of other examples in which is repeated precisely the same process we have reviewed in the case of the Manichaean and the Arian. A few centuries afterwards, for instance, the church had to maintain the same trinity, which is simply the logical side of love, against another appearance of the isolated and simplified deity in the religion of Islam. Yet, there are some who cannot see what the Crusaders were fighting for, and some even who talk as if Christianity had never been anything but a form of what they call Hebraism, coming in with the decay of Hellenism. Those people must certainly be very much puzzled by the war between the Crescent and the Cross. If Christianity had never been anything but a simpler morality sweeping away polytheism, there is no reason why Christendom should not have been swept into Islam. The truth is that Islam itself was a barbaric reaction against that very humane complexity that is really a Christian character, that idea of balance in the deity as of balance in the family, that makes that creed a sort of sanity, and that sanity the soul of civilization. And that is why the church is, from the first, a thing holding its own position and point of view, quite apart from the accidents and anarchies of its age. That is why it deals blows impartially right and left at the pessimism of the Manichaean or the optimism of the Pelagian. It was not a Manichaean movement because it was not a movement at all. It was not an official fashion because it was not a fashion at all. It was something that could coincide with movements and fashions, could control them, and could survive them. So might rise from their graves the great heresiarchs to confound their comrades of today. There is nothing that the critics now affirm that we cannot call on these great witnesses to deny. The modern critic will say, likely enough, that Christianity was but a reaction into asceticism and anti-natural spirituality, a dance of fakirs, furious against life and love. But Manes, the great mystic, will answer them from his secret throne and cry, "These Christians have no right to be called spiritual. These Christians have no title to be called ascetics. They who compromised with the curse of life and all the filth of the family, through them the earth is still foul with fruit and harvest and polluted with population. Theirs was no movement against nature, or my children would have carried it to triumph. But these fools renewed the world when I would have ended it with a gesture." And another critic will write that the church was but the shadow of the empire, the fad of a chance emperor, and that it remains in Europe only as the ghost of the power of Rome. And Arius the deacon will answer out of the darkness of oblivion, "No, indeed, or the world would have followed my more reasonable religion, for mine went down before demagogues and men defying Caesar. And around my champion was the purple cloak, and mine was the glory of the eagles. It was not for lack of these things that I failed." And yet a third modern will maintain that the creed spread only as a sort of panic of hellfire, men everywhere attempting impossible things, in fleeing from incredible vengeance, a nightmare of imaginary remorse. And such an explanation will satisfy many who see something dreadful in the doctrine of orthodoxy. And then they will go up against it the terrible voice of Tertullian, saying, "And why then was I cast out? And why did soft hearts and heads decide against me when I proclaimed the perdition of all sinners? And what was this power that thwarted me when I threatened all backsliders with hell? For none ever went up that hard road so far as I, and mine was the credo quia impossibile." Then there is the fourth suggestion that there was something of the Semitic secret society in the whole matter, that it was a new invasion of the nomad spirit shaking a kindlier and more comfortable paganism, its cities and its household gods, whereby the jealous monotheistic races could after all establish their jealous god. And Muhammad shall answer out of the whirlwind, the red whirlwind of the desert, "Whoever served the jealousy of God as I did, or left him more lonely in the sky, whoever paid more honor to Moses and Abraham, or won more victories over idols and the images of paganism? And what was this thing that thrust me back with the energy of a thing alive, whose fanaticism could drive me from Sicily and tear up my deep roots out of the rock of Spain? What faith was theirs who thronged in thousands of every class and country, crying out that my ruin was the will of God? And what hurled great Godfrey as from a catapult over the wall of Jerusalem? And what brought great Sobieski like a thunderbolt to the gates of Vienna? I think there was more than you fancy in the religion that has so matched itself with mine." Those who would suggest that the faith was a fanaticism are doomed to an eternal perplexity. In their account, it is bound to appear as fanatical for nothing and fanatical against everything. It is ascetical and at war with ascetics, Roman and in revolt against Rome, monotheistic and fighting furiously against monotheism, harsh in its condemnation of harshness, a riddle not to be explained even as unreason. And what sort of unreason is it that seems reasonable to millions of educated Europeans through all the revolutions of some 1,600 years? People are not amused with a puzzle or a paradox or a mere muddle in the mind for all that time. I know of no explanation except that such a thing is not unreason, but reason. That if it is fanatical, it is fanatical for reason and fanatical against all the unreasonable things. That is the only explanation I can find of a thing that, from the first, so detached and so confident, condemning things that looked so like itself, refusing help from powers that seemed so essential to its existence, sharing on its human side all the passions of the age, yet always at the supreme moment, suddenly rising superior to them, never saying exactly what it was expected to say, and never needing to unsay what it had said. I can find no explanation except that, like Pallas from the brain of Jove, it had indeed come forth out of the mind of God, mature and mighty and armed for judgment and for war.